Hey, thanks for listening to the Nerdist Podcast. I hope you're having a nice day, or night, or middle of the night, or mid-morning, or morning, or mid-afternoon, or late afternoon, or early evening.
Covering all your bases.
I'm covering every single base of the 24-hour time period. Because I don't know when people listen to this.
I don't know.
I really don't. I don't know. But whatever it is, I command thee, have a lovely time of the day. You were humoring me. That was a charity laugh.
I used to listen to the podcast when I was working out. I probably should have been listening to music. I'm screwing up the whole podcast opening, aren't I? But it's true. I would listen to it while I worked out.
Yep. This reminds me of your YouTube show, Cool Story Chloe.
I liked listening to your voice when I worked out.
What?
Mine.
I just fucking plugged your YouTube show. Why am I a jerk face?
It's not even like a real YouTube show. I literally just go on my camera for about for a minute and a half.
Oh, do you go on your camera, Grandma? Is that how you describe
the
it?
The tables have turned. I'm too tired to fight you right now.
For once, I am victorious. Am I cheating that Chloe Dextra hasn't fully slept in like 2 days?
And I also don't know what you win.
Because she went up to Portland to do some cosplay business? Well, that's fine. I shall take the victory.
I mean, because ultimately you're losing anyway because I'm about to fall asleep.
No, we're in a studio right now. We're in a studio with a mattress.
Exactly, it's a really comfortable studio.
It's a studio.
In my bedroom.
That's right. Yeah, I make it a studio. Because there's some sweet performance going on in here. Come on. Would you just humor me, please? The kids are listening.
I mean, that was a joke. It was a joke.
Oh, I know. Oh, I know. Not until marriage. You've got to keep your pact.
That's true. You've
got to keep your pact. Hey, I'd like to thank Stamps.com for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. Just stop it.
I didn't even try. You didn't try.
Well, sometimes it's the best segues
are the
not segues, Clodart. Stamps.com, you could do everything that you could possibly do at a post office. It's like having the post office in your home, at your computer. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. Stamps.com will send you a digital scale which calculates the exact amount of postage you need for any class of mail. And then you just hand your mail to the mailman. You slap him a high five. And then he walks off. And the sun whistles above you. And then you go back to your day. So it's just like being at the post office, except there's not a line of angry people there. And then you can just be in your underwear. Maybe not when you meet the mailman. Stamps.com has a special offer for Nerdist listeners. No risk trial. $110 bonus offer. Includes a digital scale and $55 of free postage. Do not wait! Go to Stamps.com. Click the microphone at the top of the homepage. Type in Nerdist. Stamps.com. Promo code Nerdist. This is a fun episode because I am on a roll with wrestlers. I think I'm going to start watching wrestling now because I now like so many people that are involved in it. Mick Foley, a legend of wrestling, came on the podcast. We also were set up via Twitter on a podcast date, and it completely paid off. Mick happened to be passing through Los Angeles on his way to Australia. He was here for like maybe 4 or 5 hours, and he came to our studio to do the podcast, and is a terrific guy. You can follow him on Twitter at RealMickFoley. So here we go, the Nerdist Podcast number 325 with Mick Foley.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
You have so many fans. I wanted the tweet questions.
Okay.
I just started recording. Slide your
Slide the microphone up there. A
couple things. We'll take the conversation any way you want to.
Okay, great.
But I just rewrote my first children's book. I rewrote it on the plane yesterday for a new generation.
And by the way, I love that you have the marbled composition school notebook there.
Yeah, I just take whatever my kids don't have. Whatever they don't use, rather. See what's there. Official. And I'm also in a documentary about Santa Claus, you know, in addition to the wrestling stuff.
That's
so.
And did they find him?
The real Santa?
Yeah.
What has he been missing?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, since December 25th.
Well, it takes you long. I have my sources, though. He actually runs a catering business.
So the way that we were able to get you on the podcast, first of all, it's lovely the way Twitter works. We had, CM Punk and then Chris Jericho on, and people were like, and the guy you also got to get on is Mick Foley. And then they started tweeting at you, and you tweeted at me, and I was like, this Mick Foley guy seems like an okay egg. And so we chatted a bit online, and you happened to be in Los Angeles for, 10 hours?
I just realized we're on the air now.
This is it.
When I was talking about Santa running a catering business and telling you, hey, here's how I was talking about it. Here's what I want to talk about while we're on the air.
Oh, well, we'll talk about Santa Claus.
Even though it's your show.
Well, then we'll get to that.
It is amazing how quickly that stuff can work on Twitter. I did it once with Rochelle Carey from Headline News.
Yeah.
And this was at a time when I was working for a different company, and they weren't. And I'm not putting them down, but they didn't. You know, their public relations wasn't nearly as effective as WWE is a much bigger company, and they got things done more effectively that way.
Yeah.
And here I was, like, there's Rochelle Carey, one of the anchors on Headline News, like, love to have Mick Foley on sometime. And I was like, you would? Okay.
I happen to know Mick Foley, who I am.
And that's the way it worked with this thing. I mean, it was within an hour, right? And you sense when your followers are really excited about something, like, oh, you have to make this happen. And I love the comments that are really like, my two universes have collided.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do.
Well, because what happens is people are sick of hearing me talk about how I don't know anything about sports. And so when I had Punk on, I mean, I grew up in Memphis.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I was there, like I told him, I was there for the beginning of, like, wrestling sort of as we know it.
The weekly Monday night shows.
It's sort of, like I said, told him, it looked like public access television, but it was like the Jimmy Hart and Jerry Lawler, and I was in Memphis for the, for the whole Andy Kaufman thing and all that. But I didn't really watch wrestling over the years, and then, so Punk came on, super nerdy, super great guy. Then Chris Jericho, fucking awesome. And then everyone's like, Mick Foley. And then you turn out to be a cool guy. It's like, oh my God, these wrestlers are basically just like comics in these Hulk bodies. they're like Hulkrabats, like these amazing.
Well, a lot of the guys, there are some different subsections of wrestlers. Some of them get in there. And I'm not picking a Kurt Angle, but Kurt Angle is an example of the ultra competitive guy.
Like
gets in there because he wants to be the best,
yeah,
no matter what. And like, I think everybody who does well in wrestling does it because they do want to be the best. But we define being the best in different ways. It's getting those the reactions. Like, I was the reaction guy, and Jericho's a guy brand music. Like, he's a Renaissance man, quite a good dancer. And the other guy, I think you have to get on his Edge sometime.
Okay.
Edge would kind of complete that kind of cool nerd block that, we got a
phone charger.
Yeah. Nice.
I think I got it.
I think so.
Now, do you think The Rock would be a good guest?
Well, I think he'd be a dynamite guest because he's so, you'd have to talk outside the box.
Yeah.
He just won the title again. Come on.
He just won the title.
I mean, charming man.
He's a great guest because he's a great guest on everything. I don't know if he's tailored for this show the way that, Punk is probably perfect. Jericho, maybe Edge, pretty good too.
Yeah.
And then if you get The Rock, obviously that's a huge get.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk to him about Hawaii.
That's right. Jonas from Hawaii. Someone should just take a drink in the game of the podcast where we mention Hawaii. Someone takes a drink.
Yeah, well.
And then they have to take a drink where I say that I wouldn't take a drink.
Yes,
and then it gets all meta.
Exactly.
But you're here for like just a handful of hours on your way to Australia.
True.
And so you flew from New York.
Right.
Oh, what a fucking day of travel. So New York, LA, and then you're going to Sydney and then Perth?
Then Perth, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Disastrous. When I originally envisioned this, I thought this was going to be my... Disney vacation week. And then my daughter ended up going to college. I didn't even think about that. My kids ended up already missing enough days because they were sick. Mm. During the Hurricane Sandy, we escaped the hurricane by traveling out of state, and I was on the road. And they made it down to Florida. I was like, whatever you do, don't go to the Magic Kingdom. Like, you can go to Animal Kingdom. Just don't go to Magic Kingdom. Do you think they listen to me?
No.
Magic Kingdom.
They could have gone to SeaWorld. They could have gone to Epcot
they could have
Center.
Done anything. That's how much status I have.
Harry
in my
Potter
own
World.
So that kind of took away. Like nobody's like, hey, I was only, it's been 8 weeks since I've been at Disney. You know, could you take me? So I just reworked the, then a little, that stomach bug hit me for a few days. And now I realized that adding another 6 hours New York to LA would just make it just the day that never ended.
Yes.
So I broke it up. Los Angeles is always a place I can find something to do.
Like a podcast.
Like a podcast. Like a podcast. And I stop by Adele's of Hollywood.
Yeah.
Like, liking the Santa. This is a casual. This is what
you were casual Santa today.
Yeah. He would wear in the workshop or somewhere else during the rest of the
now,
year.
Now,
you're really presumptuous. He's wearing his own face all over his clothes.
Now, when a large, shaggy man is wearing a big Santa shirt in the airport, is the TSA like, what's that guy? Something's out of whack. What's going on with it?
You know what? That's the way they look at me anyway. you know what? One of the hardest adjustments I had to make was that when you go through that, if you guys, you travel quite a
tons,
bit.
Tons, yeah.
You guys go through there.
Yeah.
And when they have the full motion body scanner, it's essentially they take a naked photo.
Yeah. Sure.
And I'm not convinced somewhere down the line there's not going to be a best of the celebrity body scans.
Oh, yeah.
So for like 6 months, I was going, no, I won't do it. I was going with the pat down.
Yeah.
Which is a really thorough pat down. And they tell, have you done it?
Yeah.
They tell you what they're doing to you.
Yep.
They're like, I am going up your inner thigh with the back.
Would you rather? Would you rather have us take a naked photo of you, or would you rather be molested? It's either one. One of them. Like, it, but you're right. There's going to be like celebrity dick outlines. Here's Bradley Cooper's wiener.
And the weirdest thing is, I actually get it. Now I've actually accepted. I'm going to do the 3 second thing and hope that technology doesn't backfire me. And when I put my hands up, if, for those not like Diamond Dallas Page bang thing, I actually find myself flexing for those 3 seconds. Like that's going to make a difference in my naked shot. Yeah.
I was traveling once, and Joe Manganiello from True Blood was in front of me. And as soon as he got into the scanner, I was just like, oh, all the TSA women were going fucking bananas. Really? And I'm like, oh, my God, his wiener has just become the lock screen on their phones.
I bet. Yeah. I bet mine is not anybody's lock screen.
You know what?
I'm glad, though, that they've made the screen in another room now.
Yeah.
Now there's not that thing where you're getting your stuff together and you can just look at the people.
Yeah.
You
is that the deal? Because people have stopped laughing when I go through there.
Yeah.
The other weird thing is that when you're online, you start trying to think of sexy things. You can have like a half an erection. When you go through,
yeah.
So that you look a little
which is
more
hard when you're traveling.
We all do it.
Come on.
We all do it, right?
And when you're in travel mode, it's not fucking easy.
Give it a little tug, a little thumb.
Come on, release it. Childlike state.
I didn't expect this line to be so long.
Turtle's coming out for this one.
Warm it up a little bit. Come on, guys. It's picture day. Let's take it out there a little bit.
Oh, man. Yeah, dating back to when, and I wrote about this, there was a guy named Dr. Eyehacker. He gave all the sports physicals when I was growing up, and There's no telling how many teenage testicles this guy has had in his hands.
Yeah.
You know, and it would be that deal where you look down and you know, Mr. Happy's decided to, like, tuck in to protect himself.
Yeah.
And you're like, not that I want to impress Dr. Ayak. This is downright embarrassing. Come on.
Yeah, you don't want to go too far in either direction. It's like, I don't want to be too soft, but I don't want to be too hard either because it's a doctor that sends the wrong impression.
There was a guy named Jay, I'll call him Jay Pinochle, even though that's not his real name.
Okay.
He still has to live a life. he was heard giggling in Dr. Eyehacker's office, and that was essentially the end of his...
No.
Yeah, that was the end of his... You know,
I'm sure that's spread around before he even walked out of that room.
Hey, Dr. Giggles.
Yeah. They invented the internet specifically to pass around the story about him giggling.
So you started wrestling in probably early 80s, right? What, like 82 or 3?
Yeah, 85 was my official start in wrestling school. So I was wrestling in 83. I was wrestling Kevin James in the Ward Melville High School wrestling room.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's right. You guys went to college. Yeah, I mean, to high school together.
And then he went to college, came in like a year later, went to college with me and hung out with me until he got like real friends. Then he abandoned me. But yeah, we had some pretty good matches. Kevin, for anyone who saw, like, Here Comes the Boom, and they were surprised, they shouldn't have been. You know, he was a tough kid, big kid. And so he was a... You know, that was a monumental undertaking every day in the wrestling room.
But that's different than like professional wrestling, which is a lot of stunt stuff.
Oh, I called a stuntman before.
Not a stuntman, but you have to know how to fall. You have to know how to land. You have to know how to take someone down without fucking breaking their neck. I mean, it's kind of...
Well, there's, you need a little cooperation to make the moves look good. And here's the funny thing is I actually started cooperating in the Ward Melville wrestling room with Kevin James because we were heavyweights, which meant we didn't have to watch our weight as long as we didn't get over 215. And I eventually did weigh in for the super heavyweight for the county tournament with a 2.5 pound weight in my jock. I was like pushing. And we realized that these guys, you know, who were starving, practically starving themselves, sucking weight as they call it, you know, really looking miserable, were working as hard as they could. They were somehow managing to sweat. You know, they may have not had a drink of water in days. And Kevin and I were like, you know, this would be a lot easier if we were helping each other out. So we would be there like, you're like calling moves out, and then Jim McGonigal, our coach, went, good work.
Oh, nice.
And it wasn't James then. Good work, Foley. Good work.
That's I feel like I saw MTV did that True Life series, and one of them was about I think it was called True Life, but it was basically just like, sections of teenagers doing stuff.
True Life, MTV True Life.
And one of them was like a high school wrestler, and it was so fucked up. This poor kid had basically an eating disorder. It was, you know, he had to weigh in, and he was like a pound too heavy, so he put on all these clothes and tried to sweat it out and pee it out, and he was going bananas and like just barely made it.
Well, that's the way it was, and then they'd have like the rest of the day they could then eat whatever they wanted. That's the way my brother was. My brother would get out, and he started wrestling before I did. So I had a lot of experience wrestling with my brother. My brother was a younger he was a tall, thin guy, and lighter weight guys wrestle a different style. So when I became a wrestler with a heavyweight, I actually adapted to it pretty quickly, and I became like the only heavyweight wrestler in the county who was a leg rider, which was a different way of wrestling. But I don't want to lose your audience too quickly about the time I was wrestling. I'll just say that my brother was 115 when he wrestled. I was 215.
Oh, shit.
And I was only a couple inches taller than him.
Oh,
so
Jesus.
My brother used to get gasps from people. And now they've changed the way they suck weight. Like, there's only a certain amount of body weight you're allowed to lose from the time you start. But he'd get gasps almost like he was just emerging from Auschwitz or something.
Oh,
almost that bad. Not making light of anybody who really suffered there. But he and my brother could be pretty tough on me as far as my weight was concerned.
Yeah.
You know, crossed out the D in the Moby Dick book and replaced it with an M.
Right, right.
Moby Dick. And I just remember going and watching my brother, because he was so tall and thin, that he would wrestle guys of like greater stature but who were smaller than him. And the one time he wrestled against Sachem High School and he took on a dwarf and lost, I just looked up at this guy and I went, thank you, God. Thank you. I'll always have this on my brother. Like, anytime my weight came up, I'm like, you lost to a dwarf.
No more Moby Mick from here on out.
No more Moby Mick for me.
So what was the transition for you from that to perfect? Because 85, by that point, wrestling's kind of getting to be like a national thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I loved it. I enjoyed doing the high school wrestling. If I hadn't have done it, no way I would have thought I could have ever ventured into pro wrestling. It really helps to have that background. And I was just one of these like dreamers, you know, who thought, I'd love, again, to get those reactions, to make people feel the way that, that I felt when wrestling was at its best. And a lot of your listeners will probably know the story about Jimmy Superfly Snuka. You guys familiar with this? Hitchhiking from my college about 250 miles away, scalping a ticket, showing up by myself, which was not unusual for me to show up by myself anywhere, which kind of made me like an outcast. That's the type of thing that people grab onto in high school. Like, I saw that guy by himself at the movies.
Yeah, that really would. It's like he ate by himself during lunch. He's a weirdo.
Yeah, he's a weirdo. Yeah. If you do that when you're older and you have some money, then you're just kind of
eccentric. So when you're going and you're watching by yourself, what is it specifically that you're seeing, or what is the experience for you?
You know, it depends largely on the matchup. Has to have a build, has to have that story, and then you willingly, as do most nerds in some element in their life, you got to suspend disbelief. You know, whether it's Star Trek or Star Wars or Santa Claus or wrestling, you know, you suspend that disbelief, and if the stuff is good enough and it looks legit and the storyline's got you hooked, then you'll do that. It doesn't hurt to throw some real good physicality in there. So, like, when Snuka came off the top of the steel cage against Morocco, like, you could look at it and go, okay, it's not really a 15-foot-high steel cage because it's only a foot and a half taller than Snuka, who is not 13.5 feet tall. But, again, you hear it so often, and then you go and tell your friends, it was a 15-foot-high steel cage, you know. People have sworn that the cell that I was thrown off of in a 1998 match with The Undertaker was 30 feet tall, you know.
And, hell in the cell match on the press table.
You know, it was a legit 16. Like, that's 6 feet taller than a basketball hoop. So you're standing up there. And speaking of Jericho, I was glad he mentioned this in his book. He said he was thinking of doing something off the top of the cell. And he said, I swear to God, people looked like ants down there. Like, you can't believe how high it was unless you're actually up there. And I was reading going, thank you. That's exactly what everything looked like. Like it was just tiny.
That was such a good match.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. That was such a good match. Thank you.
So it is. So there is a little bit of P.T. Barnum in it, of like, and this cages are 35.
You gotta do it. Yeah.
And people just like,
because I went to an independent show where they actually, the guy, you know, he ordered a 15-foot-high steel cage, an independent show. And first of all, they could barely fit it in the building. And then the guys, they wanted them to try to come off. They couldn't even stand up on top of there. And the other thing is, they're making $50. They're like, I'm not going to do that. I'm not coming off. I'm not going to do it. So, yeah, you're better off going 7.5. Yeah, I mean, we've all exaggerated our own sexual exploits, right? So why not just...
My dick is 15 feet long.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
You can barely fit it in the theater.
My dick looks like ants.
You mean Ant the comedian?
Sideburns.
The sort of I mean, it's almost like, I think it, obviously, I'm sure for anyone who gets into wrestling now, I'm sure it's really exciting because if they can hit it big pretty fast, everything's pretty much in place. But what seems like it might have been fun for you is that your evolution sort of followed this, what was a relatively nascent organization at that point, right?
WWE?
Well, just like the way that wrestling had evolved.
I know I've written several New York Times bestsellers, but you got to run Nashin by me.
I mean, like it was like an early stage, like in its infancy. It was in its infancy.
It had been around for quite a while. When I had my second match in my career, it was as a WWE extra in 1986, and they'd just gone national as far as bringing the show around to the arenas.
That's what I'm talking about. Like, as opposed to just being like a local thing that you would go and see local shows or see like on public access or like local TV stations, is like, it really had started to become a national phenomenon that like, oh, people actually watch wrestling and it's a big thing. And like, just as much as they watch football.
And it became a point where you didn't have to pretend you were not a wrestling fan. Like, there were a lot of people, a lot of closeted wrestling fans, you know, at that time. And growing up in Memphis, like you said, you would look at it, and how did you term it? It looked like it was, public access. But you would talk to somebody from Memphis, and they'd be like, no, this is the best show, and this is the best. And then you'd compare it, and it was like, why don't they at least fix the camera? That's clearly, you know, it clearly needs some white balancing or something. And they're like, oh, it works. If it works, why, you know, if it's not broke, why fix it?
Yeah.
But WWE really showed what a really good production could look like. And people gravitated towards it. You know, you kind of sometimes confuse, quality with presentation. And WWE did for a while. You know, they snuck in some guys who were just horrendous. From a wrestler standpoint, a young wrestler standpoint, it was like, what about me? Like, I knew I was working with...
Are you listening,
limited.
Brutus the Barbecue
Kid? Yeah, well, I'm picking on Brutus here.
Come on, what I'm saying, Sears?
There were, I would look and I would see some gimmicks, you know, Mantor being one. I actually was going to... That kid was going to write a children's book with the island of, you know, worthless gimmicks.
Where
all the characters didn't work out and all, like, banished to an island.
Everyone just has a prop.
And I would be like, what about me? And it was one of those things that kind of built into a healthy anger, you know, so that it kind of drove me. And even when I did this pretty famous series of interviews with Jim Ross in 1997, you know, I had a way to vent that anger in that interview, and it was pretty good stuff.
So, what is the constant mindset of a professional wrestler in terms of trying to figure out what character you want to portray and kind of staying relevant and staying ahead of the curve and being able to
staying ahead of the curve is, I mean, it's so important. Because you got to see that curve coming before other people do. And there have been guys who, during the era especially of the catchphrase, it was frustrating for me to see how easy it was for people to go out there and say the same thing every week. And I remember, you haven't heard me drop a single F-bomb, right?
No.
I usually use it as an action verb. The Foley bedroom.
Yeah.
But, I remember coming in when Paul Bearer was my manager and like trying to do one of these kind of deep philosophical things and nobody cared. And he was like, oh, don't worry. That's the way he really talked.
Don't worry.
And I was like, no, fuck them. And it was really frustrating for me. And then over time, it was like, you know what? People are going to need a little more than this. And the guys who didn't see that curve coming, I mean, and then kept up with the catchphrases, they got washed away. It was kind of sad.
It's really interesting. It almost seems like you have two wrestling matches. You have the one that you're doing in the ring, and then the one with the public. Because if they don't respond, then you're out.
Yeah, it's constantly tweaking, seeing what works, and you know, you have your creative team, and you know, you have to fight your battles. You have to choose your battles. You can't fight about everything that comes your way, even though some guys have and have been successful that way. But you have to, you know, stand up. I'll give you an example. The nerd universe, they love, and this, I'm not picking, I got to say, I'm not picking on Zack Ryder. But you guys probably have, you know, a million Zack Ryder fans out there, right? People love Zack Ryder. And this is not something I haven't told him personally. Zack will say, hey, I'm not getting pushed. I'm not getting pushed. I said, Zack, did you ever bring your case to Vince McMahon? He said, no. And I went, that's the guy you have to bring the case. You have to come to him with your evidence. Say, this is why I should be pushed. I've moved this much merchandise. I've done this. He wrote numbers. And you present it. And it's not baseball where if you hit .333, you can be the biggest jerk in the world and you're always going to have a job. I mean, it's very subjective. And if one guy is saying, I don't think he has it, and he happens to be the guy who owns the company, then you're kind of out of luck unless you can go up there and fight that battle. Wow. And like, that's the most important battle you'll ever fight is the one you have with your boss over where you are.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm really begun to gain an immense amount of appreciation for it because it's not just all those political battles and the character work, but also the physicality of it. And like, you know, on top of all that other shit, it's like, and you have to work out a lot, and you really have to eat. You know, like you have to live a certain lifestyle. I mean, unless your character is like, I'm
like mine, and you can wear a loose fitting and say you look like Santa in his workshop.
If you're wearing a sarong, then of course. But you know, but you definitely
your most revealing outfit was Cactus Jack.
But even if your thing is like, I'm a big fat guy, you still have to be in good shape because you have to jump around and fly around and fall and hit.
You know what? And if you are, especially. I'm hoping that you're not just saying that I'm the big.
You are not the big fat guy.
Because when I was really at my best WWE, I was like 275, 280.
Yeah.
And I was moving around pretty good. But I had to be able to keep up with a guy like Shawn Michaels, who at the time was like 205. And they were going to go. Like, it's not like they go, hey, just want to check with your cardio system. I'm going to lower my standards for you out there. It's like, hey, you bet, you know, you keep up or you lose out.
Wow.
Well, it is. You have to just like the same way that if you're improvising with really good improvisers, they're going to assume like if you're here, you're probably going to bring a certain level of game and you're responsible for that. Yeah. And if you don't, then that's your problem.
Yeah. I was wondering, I can't remember where I was watching something that reminded me of, I think I was watching the Royal Rumble. And I was thinking back to when I was an announcer. And whether or not I would have liked to have been comfortable in that position or been pushed to be as good as I can be.
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what? I think I would have been okay with a pat on the back. You know, like I think, but some people, like there's been some people almost combative at the announce table where you got to keep up or get left behind. And Michael Cole's a great announcer, but for a while when he was a heel Michael Cole, before like the real life babyface turn of all real life turns, which was Jerry Lawler having a real heart attack.
Yes.
Turned Michael Cole into a babyface in a way that he probably can't. You can't be the guy in the coal mine because you saw him. Everyone's going to remember Michael Cole as the guy with the completely white face saying, this is Jerry Lawler's had a heart attack. Like, he's now a babyface.
Yeah.
But when he was a heel announcer, you know, he was. He was pretty rough on those commentators, and I'd sit there and be like, I don't know how Booker takes this, you know? If I was Booker T, I'd be grabbing Michael Cole by the, you know, by the gullet and going, hey, man, you know, back off. It is. It's really, really competitive in ways that you wouldn't think.
I'm interested in exploring the idea of how, you know, how and you defined it for yourself, but how different wrestlers measure success because, you know, it's basically... It's sort of planned out, I would imagine. Well, this person's going to have the title for a while, and this
person's
going to...
Well, they think. You know, I mean, there's a long-term plan, and then plans change. For example, I was on hand at one of the tent towns in Massachusetts, which were fun towns. It was like the Cape Cod Melody Tent.
Great.
There was another
great
one in
venue.
Rhode Island. Yeah. Fun venues.
South Shore Music Circus.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, yeah. There was one in Rhode Island, too. There's a lot of fun. Great atmosphere. And then when you got your check, you're like, oh, why do we go to these crap? Because there's not many people there. But a guy came up to me, head of merchandising. He was like, hey, we're thinking of having a T-shirt for you. And I could see on my bar graph or chart that they had T-shirt and like two other items marked off. Mark Henry had every item, like every item that was possible, they had him checked off. And Barry Windham, great wrestler, but under the character of the Stalker that went nowhere, had almost every item marked off. Like they really wanted to merchandise the Stalker. And then Steve Austin comes walking up. He's like, hey, Miranda, how about a T-shirt for Stone Cold? And Jimmy, he got like, Steve, don't take this the wrong way, but the office just doesn't see a lot of merchandising potential in you. And like a year later, everyone's wearing the Austin 316. So there's a plan, but the plans change sometimes day to day.
Sure. Wow. But if you, I mean... Because obviously it's really cool if you get to be the WWE champion, but it's are you the do you become the champion for obviously for reasons that aren't necessarily like oh
we're
he really bested this
some,
guy in
we're
combat
treading on some sacred ground here. I'd rather leave some of this up to the imagination.
Okay,
but they have guys who can really carry the company, and then there were guys like me who were transitional champions. Like, yeah, he won the championship, but we don't see this guy. Like, he's not going to be the face of the company for very long. But you know what?
Like a Buster Douglas.
Like a Buster Douglas who can have that one amazing night, and no matter what he did with the rest of his career, you can't take away that incredible night.
Right.
You go back and watch that. It's amazing that the announcers are literally going, well, you know, Mike's a little slow, but he's going to turn this around. He should be taking care of Buster Douglas. These are the announcers. Yeah. They're supposed to be objective.
Yeah, you guys want to go get a pizza, or do you want to watch the rest of this?
And then all of a sudden, it's like, boom, you know, they start taking it more seriously. And so Buster Douglas is a perfect example of a guy who would never again reach that that pinnacle, but he had that one amazing night. In wrestling, the biggest challenge is that we finish our WrestleMania, which is our Super Bowl, and unlike the NFL players, you know, or the MVP, and I think I use this line where you go, what are you going to do? I'm going to Disneyland. And you interview the guy in the main event at WrestleMania. What are you going to do? Well, I'm going to get in my car at 6 a.m. I'm going to drive 200 miles, and I'm going to have a live match tomorrow.
Oh, man. Monday Night Raw. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it is. It's like, it's this, it's a lot of pressure to be at your best all the time, and the most faking that goes on is where you pretend to feel a lot better than you do. Like, that's
sure.
The irony is that you think it's all about, oh, God, look, I'm not really hurt, but I'm pretending I'm hurt, when in reality, a lot of the times it's, I'm really hurting. These people in El Paso didn't pay their hard-earned money to see somebody who's really hurting, you know?
Right.
They came to see people at their best, so it's... Full of ironies, man.
where do you go brain-wise to shut that off and just be like, well, I gotta, it's just adrenaline?
That's why I had the Christmas room. Yeah, I did. I had the holy Christmas room, and so everyone needs something to ground them.
Yeah.
And for me, it was the Christmas room, and literally thousands of women across the world. made that part up, but I was kind of grounded. I would go to amusement parks. Even when I was shopping for the shirt at Adele's, which is an amazing, you guys been there?
Yeah, it's on Hollywood.
Amazing place. Yeah. And they asked me a question. I said, you know, there's worse things that a grown man could be doing than going to Adele's of Hollywood. That's my thing. Adele's of Hollywood and the Nerdist. So.
Are you wearing a Dude Love shirt underneath the?
No, actually, it's
just happens to be a different tie-dyed shirt.
No, believe it or not, it is tie-dyed, but it's a tie-dyed snowman.
Hey!
Snowman shirt.
Snowy Garcia.
Could I get a plug in for a couple of
plug whatever
you want? Real Mick Foley. If you just go to Real Mick Foley, whether it's at Real Mick Foley for Twitter, realmickfoley.com, the website. It's got all my upcoming shows. You guys have an international audience, right?
We do.
So I've got shows coming up in 2 days, starting in 2 days in Australia, big tour of the UK in April 24th through May 12th, and shows in the US in March in Louisville and Sacramento, San Francisco, Phoenix, Flagstaff.
What can one expect at a Mick Foley show?
They can be expected. They'll honestly. I'm gonna say something to put myself down. But honestly, that's what people aren't expecting that much. They don't know what to expect. I think they expect a guy like trying to do punchlines and comedies. And it's like, you know what? It's if you like the books, if the books made you, yeah. People will be like, really, you comedy? Like I don't. You read the book, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Did it make you laugh
it
out
did.
Loud? Yes, you'll enjoy the comedy
there
show.
There you go.
And it was really the guy I'm doing the Australia tour with, Brendan Burns. He was like, he would hear me describe my show, and I'd be like, well, I use wrestling as a jumping off point to work into other subjects. He'd be like, mate, you do a wrestling show. And I said, no, I use it. I approach bigger subjects. Mate, it's a wrestling show. And when I finally went to the Montreal Comic Con, and you're like, wow, there's like 200 great comedians under one roof. If people want to go anywhere for comedy that doesn't involve wrestling, like there's a lot of alternatives, a lot of options. It's like, you know what? I'm going to wear that hat. I'm going to be the wrestling guy. And it's really made my shows a lot better.
Yeah.
Like I may branch out. You know, I can talk about Stacey Keibler and George Clooney and things like that, as long as I met Stacey in a wrestling context. So I can branch out and I can talk about, you know, I can talk about the fact that when I saw President George W. Bush waving out of the window to me, he did do the bang bang. I can go into politics and I can say, like, right there, that changed my entire view of not only him, but of foreign policy. Like, you have a United States president who knows my catchphrase. Like, that's going to explain a lot of the decisions.
Maybe that's just what he does. I bang, bang, I shoot everybody. No, George.
Mr. Sacco told them they were weapons of mass destruction.
So they're fun. You know, I've done a really bad job this year getting clips out. So I thought, honestly, WB would embrace it and see it as a natural extension of the wrestling, which is the way a lot of fans are like, okay, I completely get it, when they leave. But they're almost always taking a giant leap of faith in going there.
Yeah.
But, you know, very few people leave and say, geez, I was expecting more. It, like, almost always overperforms.
Well, that's good because that'll ensure that you can go back again and keep doing it. And
it should. It's really difficult to get the same people who will wait 2 hours in line for your autograph to try something different. Because at least they know what they're getting. You know, like, and in an economy, you can understand, all right, I'm going to pay my $20. I'm going to wait 2 hours. At the end of those 2 hours, I'm going to get a photo with the guy.
Well, people just love certainty. And so they love to – it's very – risk taking. I mean, it's hard enough to even get someone to take a risk on a clickable link that you have sent them, let alone leaving their homes and paying money to sit through something.
Look, I'm sure if you ask Adam Sandler about Punch Drunk Love, it's going to bring up like some deep feelings.
Yes,
I'm sure he considers it, and it was great work. But it's like, you know what? I know what else you do, and I'll be there waiting in line when you do that.
Well,
if you make your, you know, like, love Will Ferrell in dramatic roles, but that's not necessarily what people want to see Will Ferrell doing.
Yeah.
And I have to convince people that this is what they want to see me doing.
Yeah.
And generally, when they go and they take a chance, it that's the way they feel. But it's trying to get them there to take that chance, which is difficult.
Has it been as emotionally challenging as wrestling so far?
Oh, you know what? That's one of the things I like about it is it is like wrestling without the physical pain.
Yeah.
But it's that same sense. If something's not working, it feels like the night you're in the ring and stuff isn't working. And when things are working. Now, in wrestling, you had the benefit when you got to be a big name that people were going to give you loud. They were going to get behind you. No matter how bad your stuff looked. And I was there in 99 when my body was kind of falling apart. People were really giving me the benefit of the doubt some of these matches. But in comedy, you get like 5-10 minutes, and then that's kind of
I would say five max.
Yeah, if you're not making them laugh after five and you do like an hour show like I do, it's either, it's going right to the Q&A right there.
They're even more disappointed because they're expecting, if they know who you are, they're like, this is, should have been better, you know?
Well, I think in my case, they don't know what to expect. They're not expecting that much. They're almost ready. It reminds me when I went to see Twisted Sister in a club, and Dee Snider's he's a good friend of mine, but I was like, geez, when I went to see him like 10 years ago, I was like, he's 50, makeup on. And then you go out there and it's like, wow, you forget that these guys have done thousands of shows. Like, this isn't like a current star who gets signed and is literally doing their first live performance after a recording. Like, it's like, wow, this is the real deal. And people can see, they can sense, they got their BS detectors on. You know, they can sense when you're just going through the motions or whether you're really enjoying themselves. And I don't do it so much that I don't enjoy it. I imagine if it was a full-time job, it would be a hassle. And the hardest thing about it is actually going out there and bothering people on Twitter and Facebook. But I went to the Edinburgh show, and you see that there's 2,000 acts there over the course of 3 weeks, and the average audience for the average Edinburgh show is 6.
Yeah.
And these people are out there, the comics, handing out their flyers for hours.
Oh, yeah, the Edinburgh Festival is intense.
A dozen people there, and here I am going, oh, I guess I have to send out a tweet and annoy people who aren't interested.
Already spoiled. We're already spoiled.
So I do occasionally get someone who's like, I'm unfollowing you because all you do is plug your stuff. And I'm like, you're just unfollowing me. You're not breaking up with me.
It's not a conversation.
Thanks for your follow.
That's the other thing, too. People need you to know. Yeah. Well, I need you to know.
Unfollow! All caps. Yeah. Through the wrestling career, you portrayed, like, you became a few different characters. Yeah. And so what is the decision, like, is it sort of like, I'm kind of tired of this one and I want to turn into this one? Or how does it work?
In my case, you know, the answer is a little bit different because I was a pretty successful character as Cactus Jack. I didn't know at the time that Vince McMahon despised Cactus. He thought I looked seedy, like I wasn't a star. He didn't tell me those things. But when I was in his office the first time, and at first I was like, okay, we want to do what's best for Mike. Calling me a name that, you know, only my mom or my kindergarten teacher. My mom, when she was really angry, and it's like, man, he doesn't even really know my name. We went through some things, and he showed me a sketch of a guy in a mask. And he said, that's going to be you. And I really took a lot of pride in my, facial expressions as a way of telling stories. I was pretty down about it. And then my wife helped convince me, and Jim Ross helped convince me this is a way of, doing something different. Who knows, maybe it could even turn into something better. And it did. It turned out to be the best thing that could have happened to me because then I had Mankind as a character. A year later, Mr. McMahon found out that I'd always secretly yearned to be this Dude Love character. Saw the footage. You guys, have you seen the footage? They showed a little footage on the WWE Hall of Fame thing. I dug it out. People had seen the 1985 Loved One, but they'd never seen 1983's The Legend of Frank Foley, where I actually go through a posing routine at about 220 pounds, and I didn't look that bad. Like, I didn't look that bad, but I would look at the correlation. I'd be like, okay, I was 220 pounds. I had no job. At 2:35, I was sleeping in my car, and I was eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. I got hired at 2:50. They're getting a push at 2:65. I went to WZ. Like, hey, this is pretty clear to me where this path is supposed to take me. And then by the time you're 3:20, it's kind of like, all right, maybe I'm overdoing it here.
The Loved One, that was the Henry Winkler movie, right? No, not the Loved One. The what was the Henry Winkler wrestling movie?
I know the one. Yeah, we should look it up. Where he played a gorgeous George type character.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
It was like the world's great. It was like it was some sort of superlative, like the greatest something something. Matt, you're looking that up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Henry Winkler.
Henry Winkler wrestling.
Little Henry Winkler trivia for
please.
You. Please, Kevin James Henry Winkler trivia. The Henry Winkler character.
The one and only.
The one and only.
The one and only.
So I was way off.
The Henry Winkler character, Mr. Betcher, in Here Comes the Boom,
uh-huh.
is actually named for a real life Mr. Betcher, who is a very good friend of mine, and whose son is a very good friend of mine.
Nice.
Had one of the great quotes that I'd ever heard, driving me to a college, way down North Carolina, Virginia. You know, when it's time when you're a college senior and taking that trip, and he was talking about being in the Marine Corps, and this is a great quote. He goes, "Believe me, Mickey. Believe me. Unbelievable." And his son woke up and he said, "What, Dad? You know what you just said? Believe me. Believe me.
Unbelievable." That's going to be the new chant. That's going to be a new chant. Yeah. Believe me.
Believe me. Unbelievable.
I asked people on Twitter if they had questions for you because you have quite a rabid fan base, and so as soon as people saw, like you said, as soon as people saw you coming on, it was like, so I said, oh, if you have questions for Mick, what are they? So I have some Twitter questions for
Let's
you.
Let's hear it.
Okay, this is from @HolyToaster. Hey, Mick, saw you in Kansas, gave you a Whataburger gift card. Have you used it?
I did.
Fuck yeah!
I did not know that it was only when I was in Kansas that I got the call that I was going to Raw in Houston, and Whataburger, you know, is center based out of Texas. So I not only used it, it came out to like $9.87. Perfect. But when I'm in Texas and I don't know when I'll be back, I hit it like three times in that 1.5 day period. Yeah. Yeah,
oh, good. That guy's going to be thrilled.
Thank you very much.
This is from @DomRisk on Twitter. Will we ever see an all true biography of Vince McMahon, and are you the guy to write it?
Ooh, oh, man. Wow. You know, at one point I wanted to write a book centered around even one day at WrestleMania. I want to call it Maniac Inside the Mind of Vince McMahon.
Wow.
And I pitched it to him, and he said, you know, Mick, I think what I'd like to see is another book of yours. And I thought he was kidding me. And then a couple days later, I got a call from the publisher saying, so I hear you're going to do another book for us. And that turned out to be the Hardcore Diaries. But I thought it'd be really impossible. It'd be really, really difficult. I'm not a good enough researcher to really do a real, you know, a true biography on Vince McMahon. But I think just having full access to him for like even a few days, and then following like three or four storylines, you know, the guy who's having his last match,
mm-hmm.
the guy who's having the biggest match of his career, and the guy who's getting like the big break. You know, that could be a really fascinating book. I was also asked if I wanted to participate in the history of the WWE book.
Which, oh, that's cool.
Which I might. Hey, as long as I'm talking, can I mention something?
You mention whatever you want. This is your platform.
This is something. Maybe this is breaking news, and
please.
I want some feedback because I'm going to read two different versions of this story. I'm rewriting Christmas Chaos for the for a new generation. It's not the Attitude Era book. We're taking out, you know, the naked elf's gonna have a pair of shorts on. Like especially, you can get away with this photo with the naked elf running around, but you can't get away with this photo.
No,
he's full moon elf.
Full moon.
So at the point where Santa staggered up the stairs to talk with Mrs. Claus, but as he reached the mirror, he simply had to pause. Maybe it's my image, he thought as he wiped away his tears. I haven't changed the way I look in over 90 years. The story as written is outdated because it says, this beard will be the first to go, and then this old red suit. I'll buy myself some cool new shoes and lose these dull black boots. Then I'll buy some fancy chains like that wrestler named Too Hottie. Then poor Santa took a look at his plump and dumpy body. And then it says, at that time, his butt looked like Rikishi's did, and Santa did believe it may have been those million cookies he ate last Christmas Eve. Here's the two variations, okay? All right, and I don't have it all written down perfectly, but it said, I'll buy myself some cool new shoes. This is one, selection one, and lose these dull black boots. And then I'll buy some awesome chaps just like Shawn Michaels did. Then Santa realized he weighed three times. He weighed what, just like the Heartbreak Kid. Sorry. Awesome chaps just like the Heartbreak Kid. Then Santa realized he weighed three times. Shawn Michaels did. All right, I'm not reading it very well. The other one would be, I'll buy myself some cool new shoes and lose dull black boots, and then I'll buy an awesome robe like Nature Boy Ric Flair. Then Santa looked in the mirror and his hope turned to despair.
That's really funny.
His body looked like Brodus Clay's, same butt, same hips, same thighs. Half a billion cookies will do that to a guy. Do we like the Shawn Michaels, which was read poorly, or do we like the idea? And you're going to have the thought bubble in Santa's head. Here he has the thought bubble, like, okay, he looks like a Scotty too hot.
Now,
Santa.
I think, okay, I do have an opinion on this, and I think it just depends on what you want the tone to be. The former is more of a dig. The latter is a little more of an it's a little more like of a human, you know, like,
yeah.
So I think it depends on, does your audience want to see you take a shot at a guy or really talk about the human condition?
So you think he's taking a shot at him if he says the Shawn Michaels three times what Shawn Michaels did?
Well,
and also, he was, you know what, I was talking to the guy next to me. You guys are not the very first. The guy next to me on the plane was a pretty cool guy. And I was like, hey, what do you think about this? And he was like, you know what, if you're looking for a G-rated book, I'm afraid that Shawn Michaels chaps on Santa send the wrong message.
No, there's been a lot of changes in the world lately. Yeah. But I think you know, one, the Shawn Michaels one is more comedy, and I think the Flair one is a little more like like a little sadder in a weird sort of way.
I like that.
So just whichever way you want to go.
I think the bubble. I think Shawn Michael. I think the Ric Flair Santa as Nature Boy Ric Flair.
Yeah.
Would look funnier.
There's a lot more you can do with it.
I don't know if anyone needs to see Santa in chaps.
In the thought bubble, he should be saying woo, woo, woo instead of ho, ho, ho.
Is Santa a WWE guy?
Meaning?
I mean, Santa Claus, it's like he's a guy, he's got a character.
Yeah.
You know, it requires a tremendous amount of planning and physical.
Well, there's a rumor out there that I was Santa Claus on TV, that I was the man who got run over by Alberto Del Rio's car. I can never confirm, but I'm not completely deny that I was Santa Claus. I'll bring up a picture, though, so you guys can be the judge. But go ahead and talk.
Here we go. This is from Bryce Melendez on Twitter. Was there ever a dangerous bump that you flat out vetoed?
You know what? Honestly, I vetoed a lot of stuff. That probably surprises people because I always put myself in a position where I was in control of my own destiny.
Yeah.
Even if that destiny looked to be painful, I was in control. So if someone made a mistake, it was going to be me. I ixnayed suplexes that looked a little wild that I wasn't in control of. As you get older and you realize that guys, you know, need to get over and they need for their stuff to look good, your long-term chiropractic health may not be their first concern. So
sure.
I would tell people, look, I can't do that. I'd be diplomatic about it, and then I would usually offer them something that looked better that I was in control of. So I did, and I think it's important because for younger wrestlers, they should never be in a position where they're doing something they don't feel comfortable with. You're better off not getting booked than being in a position where you're doing something you don't feel comfortable with.
Because you're going to make a mistake.
You're going to make a mistake. You could make it look bad. You could get hurt. I mean, I visited a young man who was paralyzed in the hospital because he'd taken some kind of very dangerous suplex on his first match ever. And the only reason he was even in the ring is because he'd sold 10 tickets to his friends. And then the referee literally shoved him out of the ring with his foot. I mean, kicked him out of the ring when this is a match. It should have been stopped, should have had medical attention. So young guys should know out there that they have to look out for themselves because if they don't, you know, I'm lucky that there were people looking out for me, believe it or not. You know, like after Hell in a Cell, Vince McMahon came up to me and he said, "You have no idea how much I appreciate what you just did."
Oh, wow.
But I never want to see anything like that again.
Oh, wow.
Instead of like, awesome, can we do it higher next time?
Well, that's why it's so, you know, like, It's also like backyard wrestling videos where fucking kids jump onto. We showed a lot of those on Web Soup.
Yeah,
like,
oh,
kids,
man,
jumping off roofs.
I know. I don't do it. It encourages them. You know?
I do not.
Yeah.
Well, about Hell in the Cell, someone, Boots33, said, when you landed from your first ever fall from the top of Hell in the Cell, did your tooth bust through your upper lip?
You know what? It was actually, there was a big hole in my lower lip, so it was probably the lower lip. And it was, I do have two missing front teeth on the upper, my upper front teeth, but the ones that were lost were this half of one here and then another one that's gray that was put back in. So my, it's not an original, but you guys can laugh like it is. Like some guys claim to have a blue tooth. I actually have a blue tooth. And that was the one that ended up in my nose.
Oh my gosh. Jesus.
Yeah, so it was pretty intense.
Is it worth it? Like, is it, because like when you're young and you're jumping around and you're landing, you're like, ah, this is, I'm never going to have to pay for any of this. And then as you start to get older, you're like, what did I do to my body?
Well, I knew there was going to be a price. I didn't know it was going to be this high. Like, as I was staggering down Adele's of Hollywood's staircase, it's like, yeah, maybe I should have rethought some of those, you know, some of those
good
elbows.
Good Santa.
Yeah. Pretty good Santa, right?
That's pretty spot on.
Unless you're the teenage girl, then that is a much better makeup job.
I will tell you, 15-year-old
that's
me.
My, that's my daughter.
She's beautiful.
And the reason I love the photo is there is no sign of, as when you're a dad, you like, you almost go in knowing that your kids are going to resent you when they get to be teenagers. No resentment. They like a happy child, like, and that's my greatest accomplishment.
Oh, congratulations!
Thank you, I appreciate that.
In retrospect, is it worth it? Was it worth it? You know, if the sort of physical stuff.
You know, if it stays limited to the, stays limited to the structure, you know, like the orthopedic structure.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, if I start having bad issues with my brain, then you know, so maybe. But even if it's not worth it, then what will be worth it is hopefully people learning.
Yeah.
From my mistakes, and I think people have. You know, like you can't WWE. I don't think we've seen a chair shot to the head in a year.
Oh yeah.
Oh, someone said someone had a chair question, which was someone hit you like 11 times with a chair, and they were supposed to only hit you a couple times. What was that?
That was the moment getting the better of us. That was me and The Rock. And I was in the WWE warehouse. Speaking of photos, my wife sent me a couple dirty photos for my trip, so I don't want you guys.
Are you dressed like Santa in those?
No. Look, there's the chair that The Rock actually used on me.
Oh, shit.
And you can see the dried blood. You see that thing?
That chair is mangled with your
it was really mangled.
Body.
That was bad, you know? That was bad.
They and keep so that stuff?
They do that.
That's
it's like
awesome.
A Hall of Fame without a Hall of Fame. It's a warehouse, and I was there because they were shooting the cover for my DVD, and I was excited because instead of just putting an action shot or a promo shot, they're doing it like Masterpiece Theater, like Dinner for Five.
Oh, yes, right. Yeah.
And so they have me as the as all my characters. And I was, you know, Cactus, Dude Love, Mankind, Mick Foley. And I was like, but there's five. And they're like, yeah, what are we going to do? I was like, I brought the Santa outfit. So I was in the warehouse and looking around. It was, you know, they have the Hell in a Cell there.
Oh, that's
got
amazing.
They got everything.
I want to go.
They have stuff that I sent them years ago, I think because I was going to have it be part of the WWE auction and they decided to keep it. But it was like the outfits my wife made for me when I was in WCW in 91.
Wow.
Some cool stuff going back to World Class. The chair that's all mangled. Wow. So
just
someday.
One room full of ripped yellow shirts from Hogan. Yeah. All the leftover Bret Michaels sunglasses he would give us.
I'm surprised they haven't turned that into some kind of a money-making venture. People would pay to see
that.
I
think what they need to do is find the right venue. And I think it's like, you know, if you put it on its own, maybe people aren't going to go out of their way just to visit WWE Hall of Fame. I mean, there are times in the year when, you know, Cooperstown is, you know, baseball Hall of Fame is pretty barren. But I think if you put it in an attraction, like
put it in Vegas or something.
They should. Why don't they tour it? Why don't they tour it?
Caesar's Palace, home of the worst WrestleMania.
that was a little bad,
it was
right?
Terrible.
Yeah. Was that Undertaker, Giant Gonzalez?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Giant Gonzalez, one of those guys that you're like, really? He's just big.
Why don't they tour it? Like they could tour it with You know, like just
they did. They did have a little tiny tour.
But they have so much. I mean, stuff so vast that they could have their own building.
They should put it in the Hilton where the Star Trek experience no longer exists.
What? I know.
It's all gone.
The worst day of my life.
Yeah, can you believe it?
We haven't talked any Star Wars. Is that okay?
What do you want to talk about?
No, I got to tell you, man. When I was younger, you had to pick between Rocky and Star Wars. I went Rocky. So I never was enamored the way I saw the first three, and I've met several of the guys over the years, you know, who were in the Star Wars. You know, Kenny Baker and I used to talk.
Oh, that's great.
You know,
you should have had Kenny Baker beat your brother in a wrestling match.
Yes. Yeah. Dressed as an Ewok.
But no, I mean, I don't want to lose my nerd credibility, but I was never caught up with it like a lot of people, like a lot of people were.
Yeah. Star Trek or Star Wars? Which one?
All due respect. Favorite Star Wars? You know what? Wasn't it The Return of the Jedi?
That's your favorite one, The Puppet Show?
And I saw a bunch of these Star Treks, which were very good.
Yes. Yeah.
And even the retelling was very good. So I'll wander in and see it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm wondering. And if I think that Captain Kirk is going to make love to a purple woman, for example, or a green woman, then I'll tune in to watch that.
What do you like to watch? Like, is there any? Are there any shows you're watching? What kind of personal stuff are you into?
I have to tell you, I became a RAIN online volunteer, like a sexual assault volunteer, help people, and it kind of took up most of my viewing time. And I don't do it anymore. I wish I could say I did, but I got out of the habit of watching all my favorite shows, which were like Dexter. Yeah, Californication, Nurse Jackie was another.
Really,
one
just
I
everything
like.
On Showtime.
Yeah, New Girl. I like some Larry David. You know, I love some of those shows, but I'm not real up. And when I do catch an occasional show, I've never seen Big Bang Theory, not once.
Never seen it either.
I've seen like two Glees. Before this, last year's The Voice, I'd never watched a single episode of like a contest reality TV. And the only reality TV shows I've watched are the ones I've appeared on or where I have friends on. So I'll watch
Celebrity Apprentice.
Celebrity Apprentice, or I'll watch Celebrity Drug Rehab. Hey, I got a friend of mine on there.
Oh, no.
Hope it does well. Tell us a little about your work with RAIN.
Yeah, I was a volunteer. I linked on there because I was a huge Tori Amos fan, and I thought that sexual violence was something that was just handled by survivors and women. And then when I was on there, I was like, hey, this is exactly where a guy could be helping out. You know, like I had hoped, I still hope, but sometime we'll do like some kind of PSA with all the unlikely allies, like the pro wrestler, the bull rider, the car rider, the football player. You have six or seven guys with the right message, and it could be pretty powerful. I was asked by a group in Chicago to speak out against Rampage Jackson. I guess he did a video, like a spoof video on how to rape a woman.
Oh
Jesus. Jesus Christ.
I was asked about the subject of rape humor by TMZ, and I think my answer is too serious because it never aired, and this was right after somebody from WWE, Isaiah Washington, was that his name? He was let go for saying that his tag team was going to be like Kobe in a Colorado hotel room, unstoppable. But for comics who think that it's free game, that it's their right, it's like, yeah, it's your right if you think entertaining people involves bringing up the worst experience that someone's ever had in their life and having them relive it at your show.
Sure.
That's not what... I may not be the best comic in the world, but no one's going to have the worst time of their life at my shows. And so I was asked about what I thought about, humor revolving on rape. I said, theoretically, it's possible. And there are jokes that show great empathy for for the survivors or the victims. And so you can find humor in it done the right way. Springtime for Hitler is one of the, who doesn't laugh? Why? And it's like Hitler humor would have been considered taboo, but there's a way of making almost anything humorous. But I said it's kind of like hitting the help me with my baseball
nail on the
slider down and away. Like yeah, you can hit it, but more often than you're going to look bad so often going for it.
Most of the time you will foul it off your ankle.
Well, I think and you're just better off leaving that one.
You know,
alone,
the common threads on the website about, because obviously we're comics and we have comedians on, and some comedians do take on stuff as a challenge to sort of see if they can make difficult things funny, and people always debate about it, and they go, well, it's comedy, you shouldn't be upset. Other people go, well, yeah, but that's really fucked up, and if you went through something like that, then why would you, you know, and someone sort of condensed it into this point of like, look, it really all depends on who the butt of the joke is.
Yeah.
And if it's someone who is, you know, because comedy is supposed to sort of, their point was, you know, comedy is all about tearing down or maybe even Mel Brooks said this, sort of like tearing down the powerful, like whatever is in power, and sort of, you know. And so if you go after someone who's in that position, they are not in a position of power. So why would you kick someone when they're already down? Yeah. It was sort of the point, like, you know. So I think maybe that has a lot.
And, you know,
to
just, you learn statistically from being a volunteer that you go into any group of people, and somebody in there is a victim of sexual violence, or somebody knows somebody, whether they know it or not, because it's talked about so seldomly. So, you know, my hope by getting involved is I could be part of a larger conversation where you could go around and you'd be like, listen, there are things like muscular dystrophy and cancer like that we can't stop. You know, like a kid with muscular dystrophy has a death sentence. Like, there is no cure. Every day a kid lives with muscular dystrophy is a day closer to the day they die, unfortunately. Like, you accept that. But then you take something like bullying or sexual violence.
In fairness, every day we live is also a day closer to the day we die.
That's true. Not me, man. Not me.
All right, but not at 16.
Sure.
You know, you know, I have a friend who lost 3 children before they were 17.
Jesus.
And so you take these things that you can't change, and then you compare them to ones that are completely preventable, and you say, why, you know, this, even for guys who have a good time and come on and have their outlets and have, you know, a good life, there's a lot of pain involved in day-to-day living, you know. So why exacerbate that when we have the chance to eliminate it?
Well, I also think that, you know, because my stance in comedy for a long time is always like, well, and it's sort of shifting a little bit, I think, because I'm empathetic to people who get bummed out about things.
Yeah.
And so I guess the way that I sort of feel about it now is like, look, I respect that a comic can do pretty much whatever they want. There will be consequences if they broach certain topics, and there are certain things that I won't.
You know, like in some situations, especially with this subject, what I'd like to be able to do is instead of firing off, and I shouldn't have named the guy, because I really did, I wanted to go and maybe present my case and say, do you guys know how much pain this causes? Like, are you aware? Because, you know, I did a speech one time for like 300 military members for RAIN. And I took that standpoint that if you knew what type of pain was, you know, you were creating, you wouldn't do it. Like, I don't think, I would ask survivors on the hotline, like, do you think they know what they did? And a lot of times it's no. Do you think they know the amount of pain that you've been? No. And if you went to somebody and said, this is the worst thing you possibly do to somebody, like this thing you thought was just, you know, something for a night and then you move on from, and then some of these guys become like serial abusers, you know, where they specifically look for women who can't make a decision because they're too far, too heavily under the influence. But if you say if you spelled it out for most people, I have to believe that most people would not decide to create that type of pain. And then afterwards, when we were having a little something to eat, the lady from RAIN goes, you know, I really liked your speech, but I disagree with you. And I said, really? What about? And she goes, I think they do know how much pain they're causing, and that's why they do it. And I was like, ugh. Like, you know, like, it's just, I felt like I'd been kicked in the stomach. And I have to believe that's different. There are people. I just saw the biggest downer movie of all time. Did you see, anyone see, We Have to Talk About Kevin, or We Need to Talk About Kevin?
Oh, We Need to Talk About Kevin, yeah.
Holy crap.
No.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's brutal. Tilda Swinton. Right.
Yeah, Tilda Swinton and John C. Reilly in a very un-John C. Reilly role as a dad. As a good dad, but he's a dad of like the kid from hell.
Yeah.
And there's a kid who obviously just enjoyed creating misery.
But, the brutal movie, yeah.
I think there's people few and far between. We better lift this show up a little bit.
I think it's good and I think it's important and it's interesting what you said about, you know, is getting guys, and I feel like this is ultimately what you were saying, is getting sort of icons from kind of, you know, dude-heavy professions that a lot of other dudes look up to.
Yeah.
Because I think probably what happens sometimes is, you know, dudes look up to you or like guys in the UFC or, you know, or like you said, rodeo guys. And they're like, oh, they're big, tough guys. They probably like to fuck people up and do all sorts of fucked up shit. And like they I think they almost think they're emulating you, but they're not. But they have it wrong.
Yeah. And if they see somebody making light of it on a video or an interview, then it creates that feeling that you said, it compounds that feeling.
But I think having more dudes stand up and be like, hey, dudes, don't be a fucking dickhead.
Dudes of the world.
Don't be a dickhead. I think here's one more.
Yeah, we better take a tweet. Yeah, take a question.
Take one more. But this was really, you know, I think it's important because I think people like seeing this side of you and they like hearing it. It's interesting and it's something that you care about and that makes it important. To them, like that's so I don't think it's a downer. I don't think it's weird. We talk about a lot of serious stuff on the podcast. So I think it's good. And if it helps people, and if it where would they go? Rain.org?
Yeah, RAINN.org, and that's whether they are someone in need of help, know someone in need of help, or they want to volunteer, donate. RAINN.org. It's free. It's anonymous and very easy to use.
Okay.
That's great.
And so I guess one of the last tweets that I think we have time for here comes from Dom Risk. Who was a better wrestler to work with, Bret Hart or Shawn Michaels? And was Shawn really a dick or portrayed badly?
Man, I hate, you know what?
Don't hold back.
I hate to choose sides because they were both so good. They both of them were great.
They were both huge dicks.
As a matter of fact, I'm working on my thinking about my Hall of Fame speech, and I'm thinking of centering it around Madison Square Garden and trying to cover everything.
Don't ignore the Worcester Centrum.
I'm trying to do the Tombstone version of Wyatt Earp instead of the Kevin Costner one.
Yes! Yes!
Dense it. You give people, you know, you center it around a focal point. And there were only two house show matches that I wish I had on videotape, like matches that were so good I wish I had them, that are, you know, just gone, except in people's minds. And one of them was with Bret Hart in either Manchester or Birmingham, England, and the other was with Shawn Michaels at Madison Square Garden. And I always got along really good with Shawn. I mean, I loved wrestling him, and he was the perfect opponent because he was small enough to where I could do, like, big guy stuff. Even going back to 96 and Mind Games, like, there's no one else I could have done the back suplex, turn into a cross body off the top rope through the table with, because I wouldn't have felt comfortable doing it with anyone. I don't think I could have controlled and ensured the safety of anyone else. I really got along good with him, but I think he'd be the first to admit that he was not portrayed inaccurately back then. And if there was ever a case of somebody redeeming himself and having like the greatest second act ever in pro wrestling, it was Shawn.
Wow.
Even though you guys chose to vote down Shawn Michaels' appearance in the reworking of my...
If it's somebody, it's going to be Ric Flair.
You can bring him back when you write your Vince McMahon book, which should be called Mick, M-I-C-K, Man, M-A-N.
Ooh. Here's my question for you.
McManiac.
Why did they never decide to just score the plastic ribbon that runs around those folding tables? Because that looked like the most painful part of going through a table.
Oh, well, now they have that custom built the announcer's tables with the slot for the
Now see, and that's the thing, and kids that are doing backyard wrestling do not have custom tables with the slot.
Yeah.
They just have tables.
Yeah, regular table.
But like those folding tables, you know, with the metal legs that come out.
Yeah.
The ones that you would go through normally.
I wonder
a rubber band or a plastic band.
You know what?
Like would catch your neck.
There's a history of a few injuries. Through that. But can I close here on the dumbest thing I've ever heard?
Yes.
Okay. Prior to 2 weeks ago in Kansas City, I thought this was the dumbest thing I'd ever heard from a wrestling fan. The guy sees me get out of my car to Jiffy Lube, and he goes, oh, man, moving kind of slow, huh? And I said, yeah. And he goes, I guess that wrestling really takes its toll. I said, yeah, it does. And he looks me right in the eye and goes, you ever get hurt doing that? What? This is the dumbest thing I've heard in my life.
Did we not just talk about the toll?
Did we just cover that? And then the guy in Kansas City comes up to me and goes, and I make this little joke out of being like Bill Murray in Groundhog's Day for the last 15 years, getting the same question every single day. And so the guy goes, I know you don't like to talk about Hell in a Cell. He goes, but I couldn't help but notice that when The Undertaker threw you off that cell, you landed on a table. And I said, yeah. And he goes, and it broke your fall. And I said, you know what? It was a magic table. And he goes, you didn't get hurt? I said, not at all. He said, that's what I thought. And he walked by, and I just made mental note, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life.
Oh, jeez.
Well, this was really nice to have you on. Because initially I thought, I'm not going to be in New York until, I think I'm performing in April in New York, and so I thought that's going to be months. And then come to find out, you were on your way to Australia.
Yeah, it worked out nice. I had those 10 hours in L.A., and we made it happen.
You're going down to Under Earth Summer, which is basically the underside of the Earth is having there.
Oh, wow.
There's summer. You know what? This is nice. I wanted to say this is a nice fuzzy way to end the podcast. This guy, RJ409, says, Chris, can you please have Mr. Foley say hi to my brother, Aaron? He's a special needs guy and a biggest fan of Mankind.
Nope. No can do. To quote Daryl Hall, I can't go for that. No can. Aaron, how are you doing, buddy? Nice to meet you. And thank you very much for being a fan.
You just broke Jonah.
That's so fucking funny. I love that. That is
thanks, man. We appreciate all you guys. And honestly, I just love those This Is My Worlds colliding when they see, like, Mick Foley Nerdist. Like, that's awesome. So glad we were able to make that happen.
Yeah, so follow at Real Mick Foley. Go see Mick live and at any of the English-speaking countries that we mentioned, Australia, England.
Go to his website, realmickfoley.com, or go to my website, realmickfoley.tv.
Or if you're in L.A. and mix in L.A., go to Adele's.
Adele's. Stalk me at the airport.
Look for the new book, the new version of Christmas Chaos.
He's a big shaggy guy in a Santa shirt. Which one?
Yeah.
No, there's really just the one guy.
I have to pitch this to WWE. I have to pitch it to the marketing team as to why they should have a reworking. And I'm thinking, like, maybe as, like, a bonus, you know, make it a paperback. Like, 26 of the illustrations can stay.
I'll tell you why. I know why. I'll tell you what your pitch is. Pitch it for like a tablet.
There
say,
you
know what? I wanna make it into an app, like a tablet app. But since we're doing that, maybe I'll update some of the references.
There you go.
Boom.
All right.
I think it'd be easy. Yeah. I spent 6 hours rewriting it. Very happy. Took out the scene where Rudolph's being beaten up by all 7 deer. Even though you could argue that he deserves it because he's very selfish.
Like, a fast showboat, if you will.
Yeah. He just is a bragger and Santa. Well, can I I'll read this one line to you guys. And then I'll go. Okay.
Sure.
This is Santa A's saying, Santa's firing back at Rudolph. He says, there was a time I needed you and your nose to get through storms. But since Ben Franklin flew his kite and Thomas Edison was born, your big red nose is useless. I've got other ways to see. Radar, sonar, GPS, and flashlight batteries. I've had it with your selfish ways. Of your bragging, I've grown tired. And I won't take it anymore. For as of now, you're fired.
Nice. No chance.
If you're walking to the airport and you drop your notebook and someone picks it up, they're going to see your shirt and see what you're writing. And like, this guy really loves Christmas. He just loves it. That's he awesome. Loves it.
This guy must be the Christmas billionaire that writes everything Christmas.
All right. Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Thank you.
Mick Foley.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Stamps.com. Go to Stamps.com, click on the radio microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in Nerdist for a $110 bonus offer, including a digital scale and $55 of free postage. That's Stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist.